بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to all of you to this webinar on the rules of fasting in the month of Ramadan. Alhamdulillah for the opportunity and Alhamdulillah for the upcoming arrival of the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is a huge, huge blessing from Allah, and we should consider ourselves very lucky that we are, inshallah, about to be greeted by it and be gifted by its blessing and by being in it. And unlike the type of propaganda that goes on about, I don't know, like long fasts and these sort of things where people sort of sometimes feel discouraged and feel the month of Ramadan is a month of difficulty, we need to look at it. My suggestion is that we need to look at it from a different perspective, which is that it is an amazing blessing from Allah, and it is the best of months and the best of opportunities. If it's the case that there are some concerns about you know, the long fast and these things, we need to learn the rules, and that's why we are gathered here today. We want to learn the rules and understand what is our responsibilities when it comes to the fasting of the month of Ramadan. But the month of Ramadan itself is a huge blessing, and Alhamdulillah, we are about to, inshallah, experience that. So may Allah reward you all for your intentions and in joining this webinar. Inshallah, what we're going to be doing is, if you look at the slide, we're going to be looking at a few different things. Rather than going through all the rules, what I thought that we would do this time is to look at some of the more commonly asked questions and issues that are coming up, and inshallah try to address it that way. So we're going to be looking at a little bit about the philosophy of fasting, but then mostly covering the rules, looking at issues like fasting for children who are not baligh, what if I can't bear it, and that would apply to both you know, children who are baligh but are young, or even adults who find it difficult to fast. What are the rules regarding that? And we're going to be looking at some issues relating to fasting and travel, particularly like those who are traveling for work and might think that they're frequent travelers. What are the rules regarding that? Fasting for expecting and feeding mothers, what are the rules regarding whether they have to, and if they don't, what do they have to do in terms of making it up? Fasting for those who are sick or for whom you know, harm will be caused. And what if I have qada left over? Like, we still have a few days before the month of Ramadan. Let's say I have some qada fast. Do I have to make them up, or do I not have to make them up? And what's the consequence if I don't make them up? Inshallah, look at that. And then looking at some things, the common things that might break someone's fast, and sometimes people have questions about, and also the issue of taking medicine. And we'll see how much, inshallah, we can get through in the time that's allocated. If at any time any of you has a question, you're free to type it in the chat window. Okay, so why should we fast? What is the philosophy behind fasting? Now, in Islamic law, when we ask the question why for a particular law, there are two answers to that question. One of them has to do with why, as in like, what is the proof for this being a rule? What is the proof for this being something that's wajib? Meaning, where in the Islamic sources of the Quran and the Sunnah, do we have evidence for this being a rule? And then another time we ask why, we're looking to know the wisdom behind it, meaning that what is it that Allah wishes for us to get out of doing this or refraining from that? So if you look at this verse from Surah Al-Baqarah, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا كتب عليكم الصيام كما كتب على الذين من قبلكم لعلكم تتقون. Yeah, inshallah, we're going to get to the swimming thing. Somebody asked about swimming. We'll get to that when you're talking about the common things. And if it's not clear at that time, then make sure you ask me. This verse is actually gives us both an evidence for why it's wajib, and also the one of the wisdoms behind it. Meaning that based on this, it is something which is wajib. It's prescribed. It's something which is wajib. And the purpose is mentioned as well, to لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ, that there's a possibility and there's a hope and a desire that through this process of fasting in the month of Ramadan, that we may gain and increase our taqwa, increase our awareness of Allah, increase our practical demonstration of being able to be a slave and servant of Allah. So that's one thing that inshallah we're aiming to get out of fasting. And if you look at that, the hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he says that Islam is founded upon five: the salah, the zakah, the hajj, the sawm, and the walaya. Now, this is very important, that one of the five pillars of Islam that really makes up what Islam is all about is fasting. And if you look at it, fasting has an effect both on an individual level and also on a social level, where on an individual level, somebody who fasts, they can gain taqwa, they can demonstrate that they are truly slaves of Allah, and there's a lot to be gained from that. Even on a social level as well too, in an Islamic society, when you have the entire nation fasting, then it serves as a means of purification for the whole nation as well too, and it's incredibly important as a means of purification and of renewal and spiritual renewal for an entire community as well. And Islam being a personal and a social religion, when it says that fasting is a pillar, then it's a pillar for both the individual and also for the Islamic society as well. Okay, now the question of should children who are not baligh fast? This is something that comes up where there's, there's children who are not baligh. Parents are thinking that, okay, well, I need to, how should it be with my child? Should I be encouraging them to fast? Should I reward them for fasting? Should the communities have contests where they give prizes to children who fast who aren't baligh? If you look at this hadith of Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says that at the age of 7, we ask our children to fast to their capability, either half of the day or more or less, and we order them to break their fast when they become hungry or thirsty. This is so that they become used to fasting. Thus, you should ask your male children to fast at the age of 9 and tell them to break their fast when they are thirsty or hungry. Now, this issue of like the Ahlul Bayt asking their children to fast at 7 and then them telling us to ask our children to fast at the age of 9, some of the ulama have interpreted this to say that whenever it is that our children have the ability to fast, and also that desire as well too, even if they're not baligh, we should ask them to fast. It would be somewhere between 7 and 9 years old. But then we should ask them to do so in a way that when they feel hungry or thirsty, then they break their fast. And this is something that's important, meaning that we don't encourage them to keep on fasting even despite that hunger or thirst. So based on that hadith, based on other hadith as well too of the Ahlul Bayt, here are some suggestions that we would have for young children. One of them is that fasting before physical maturity as well, meaning that a child is very young. Like let's say they're 5 years old, 6 years old, or younger. It shouldn't even be encouraged at all, even for like a partial, even a half a day. Fasting after physical maturity has developed, but before coming of age, meaning that let's say they're between, 5 or 6 and 9, then it should be encouraged, but in that way that the Ahlul Bayt explained for us, that they fast, but when they feel hungry or thirsty, then they're asked to break their fast. And experience has shown that when parents manage things this way, then children actually they develop this super keenness, this real desire to want to be able to fast the whole day. And if the parents tell them that no, you're not of age yet, you're not baligh yet, but they're allowed to do these half fasts and these partial fasts, then when they do come of age, then it'll be something very exciting for them, that now I have the honor of being able to fast and keep my fast even when I'm hungry and thirsty, I still bear that difficulty. Now, as people who are you see this in different communities and cultures where, and it varies. Sometimes you'll have people who, whenever they see young children in the month of Ramadan, I don't know what it is. Maybe because they're feeling the pain of fasting, they feel like they have to make the children feel the pain as well too. So they ask them, "Are you fasting as well too?" And they kind of make them feel bad if they're not fasting, and kind of encourage them if they're not fasting. And then, like I said, communities even will give rewards and competitions and that type of thing for children, young children who fast. And that should be discouraged because it's not in line with the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. When it comes to young children, there's no obligation, and it's not even something which is recommended for them to even try. Okay, now, what if I can't bear the fasting? Now, this applies to sometimes, like, this comes up for, like, let's say girls who have completed 9 lunar years and have not, are now considered to be of age and baligh according to Islamic law, according to the common opinion among the jurists. Or let's say there's, somebody who just, maybe they live in a place where, it's a very long fast or it's very hot and they're concerned about fasting. So what are the rulings regarding not being able to bear it? Okay, the general, so let's say somebody has a 9-year-old daughter, and, is let's is that too young? Like, is that not just, she's 9 years old, she's just a child. Yes, she's baligh, but that's still very young. The answer is that fasting is an obligation on those who have come of age who are baligh, unless it entails significant harm or unbearable difficulty. Meaning that if she can do it, then she has to do it. If she can't do it, she shouldn't do it. It's very clear, very simple. Now, in this regard, like whether it's for a 9-year-old or whether it's for even adults, right? We should understand that the human body is amazing at being able to adapt to different circumstances. And sometimes, like, we're the ones who kind of create this sort of psyche and make this impression that this is something which is unbearable. Whereas, like our 9-year-old daughter or even ourselves, if we just put our mind to it, we realize that, hey, this isn't a big deal at all. And I really want to emphasize this because in we're finding that, especially in the last couple of years or so, there's sort of a trend to kind of to make it kind of be the make it seem like strange or that we were asked to fast so many hours, or like kind of cast this shadow of doubt on this whole thing of fasting, in summer hours, and I don't know, all these sort of things. This is something which it's not, like I said, like the a lot of it is just we're creating it for ourselves. And I have a friend who a colleague who went to Sweden for the month of Ramadan recently, and he was saying how there was some it, during sometimes like the fasting would be for 22.5 hours out of 24 hours people would be fasting, but he said that he saw amazing displays of people just basically taking it in stride and adapting to it. And he said there would be people who right before iftar they would go on a bike ride, they would do their nafila prayers because they knew that they wouldn't be able to do the salat al-layl like in the nighttime, and it would be a community affair and everything. It was a great sort of spirit in the air. The mosques were packed and everyone was fine. The other thing we have to realize is that the social effect of having a community fast together is really amazing. I can just ask you to do a thought experiment, which is that let's say can't fast in the month of Ramadan, like they're traveling or they're sick or something, then they have to make up a fast outside of the month of Ramadan. If you compare it, the difficulty of doing it outside of the month of Ramadan versus doing it inside of the month of Ramadan, it's a lot harder for people to do outside of the month of Ramadan. If those of you who have might have experienced in the past, you realize that it's a big chore, right? But when everyone is doing it and it's the month of Ramadan, like it becomes something which everyone helps each other and there's a morale boost and a lot of it, the point is that a lot of it is psychological. Okay, now, what if I'm fasting and things do get difficult? Okay, let's say I've started my fast and, things are really difficult, right? Now, if at any point I feel, if you look at the chart here, if I feel that continuing will involve unbearable weakness or extreme difficulty, then I'm allowed to break my fast, eat or drink the amount necessary. But then I refrain from eating or drinking any more than that. And then at some later date outside of the month of Ramadan, I make up the qada for that fast. Now, I just want to have emphasize here that the rulings are that it has to be unbearable weakness. It's not just weakness or, a lot of weakness is unbearable, and also extreme difficulty. Okay, now, let's say that it's not unbearable weakness or extreme difficulty, but it will make me incapable of performing work which is essential to my livelihood. Meaning that, I have a job and my fasting is directly making me, incompetent, incapable. I don't have any other way of making an income. I need to make this livelihood This is my source of livelihood. Then same thing applies that I can eat or drink the amount necessary, refrain from eating or drinking anymore, and then do qada'a at a later date. If that's not the case, then I can bear it with the way of the difficulty of patience, inshallah, will be rewarded even more. Okay, now, what if fasting will make me sick or harm me? If I fear that I will be harmed by fasting, fasting is not obligatory on me. Okay, very simple. Like, if I fear, it doesn't have to be the case that I'm sure of it, or that even that I think that this might be the case. Even if I just fear that I will be harmed by fasting, and being harmed meaning that it would be something like considerable harm, then it's an obligation. So, for example, let's say that I won't be able to take heart medicine at the right time. Let's say I have to take heart medicine every 8 hours. I have to. If I don't do that, then it's gonna, you know, result in like heart issues for me. In that case, then I can't fast, and I would just have to do qada at a time. You know, if there's a time that if there is a time where I am able to, then I need to make a qada. Now, I just want to highlight here this thing about fasting based on rational grounds, which means that sometimes people have fear, like, and it's not based on rational grounds. It's just kind of like, yeah, I'm scared that, like, you know, fasting in the summertime is going to, I'm just scared, you know, but it's why? No, I'm just scared. It's just, I just feel scared. I've been kind of spooked out by just talking to people about it. And that's not valid. It has to be based on rational grounds. Like, there's some justification for why you have this fear. Now, what if a doctor, what about doctor's opinion? The doctor's opinion, let's say I talk to a doctor. Doctor says that, you know, fasting for you is going to be a problem. Now, if based on the doctor's word, I get this fear of it being harmful to me, then that's good enough. I don't have to fast at that point. But let's say the doctor tells me something, but I'm sure that, you know, I'm able to fast and it's not going to cause me any harm, then I have to fast. Similarly, if I go to the doctor and doctor tells me that everything's good to go, you can fast, it's not going to cause you harm, but I know myself, I know that it is going to cause me considerable harm, then I can't fast. Now, if I do fast despite there being harm, despite the fear of harm, then, you know, if there actually was harm in the fasting, then I have sinned. I've actually committed a sin and the fast is invalid. So, you know, if it's the case that there's a doctor and I really, you know, I believe this doctor, like, it's causing me, like, you know, fear of it causing considerable harm to my body, then I don't have to fast. And if I do fast and it causes that harm, then I've done something haram. Okay, another similar ruling. This is about, not about harm, but like getting sick. And there's people who, you know, they're fine, they're healthy on one day, but they know or they fear that they're going to get sick if they fast. In that case, that would also be a valid reason for not fasting. So let's say the one example would be that there's somebody who, that's just their nature. Like in the summertime, for example, when they fast, they will get sick, and they know that, or they fear that they're going to get sick. And it's not just like, you know, feeling weak or feeling hungry. It's actually like getting sick. In that case, then that would be fasting would not be valid. Or there's another example that I gave in the slide where, let's say I just recovered from an infection, and today is like that day that I'm fine, but I'm recuperating, I'm fine, but I know that if I fear that if I fast today, then I'm not going to be able to, I'll get sick again, basically. In that case, then I don't have to fast, and then I just have to make the qada sometime later outside of the month of Ramadan. Now, for an elderly person, if there's somebody who's elderly, if they look at fasting and they say that, you know what, fasting for me has a lot of difficulty, or I can't do it. Okay, so in both those cases, there's a special rule that they don't have to fast for that day then, or they don't have to fast, meaning that if it's something which is, you know, like they just can't do it or it has a lot of difficulty and it's every day, then they don't have to fast. They're exempted. There's no sin. The only, sort of consequence is that they might have to give the fidya. And we'll talk about what fidya is in detail, but just briefly right now because it's been mentioned. Fidya is giving 750 grams of food to somebody who is a Muslim and a mu'min who is deserving of receiving that food. And there's a special ruling here regarding Ayatollah Khamenei, and if the elderly person later on regains the ability to fast, then they would it's itiyat wajib for them to make up those fasts that are missed. Okay, what if I'm sick? What if I get sick in the month of Ramadan? Very similar to what we just talked about here. If I fear that, let's say I'm sick, right, and I fear based on rational grounds that fasting is going to intensify my sickness, meaning that I'm sick, is it making me more sick, or is going to prolong my recovery, meaning that I could have gotten healed in 3 days, but because I'm fasting, it's going to take 10 days, or it's going to increase the pain. In all these cases, then I don't have to fast, and I shouldn't fast in some cases. Now, just some example. Let's say I'm sick and I need to constantly drink foods to get better. If I don't drink foods, I'm not going to get better. In that case, I can't fast. All right. Let's say I have a mild cough, and fasting might keep my throat feeling uncomfortable. Now, here, it's true that I have this sickness, but it's not something which, having a mild cough is really not considered to be like, meaning that if this goes back to like the perception of it, like in the what is it normally viewed at in the society? If having a mild cough typically is not considered like being sick, if it's like really mild, so in that case, I should fast. But let's say that it's not it's have a cough which is like people who hear it be like, yeah, this person is sick. In that case, then I wouldn't be able to fast. Now, in some cases, if I'm sick and I do fast, and it causes harm, meaning that it causes me to get more sick or it prolongs my sickness, then it will also be haram for me to fast that day. Okay, let's say that I don't fast because I'm sick. Okay, in that case, then what is the consequence? So there's one time when I get sick, okay, I don't fast for, let's say, a day in the month of Ramadan, and then, I get better again. So then I have to do the qada, and that's what's wajib on me. But I don't have to give any sort of fidya. On the other hand, if I'm sick and that sickness lasts until the next month of Ramadan, for example, somebody has diabetes, and because of their diabetes, they have to, whatever reason, they can't fast, then in that case, then as long as that condition lasts until the next month of Ramadan, then there would be no qada, and then they would just have to give the fidya. What about expecting mothers or mothers who are feeding? Okay, both of these are cases where, in a lot of times, women who are pregnant, they find it very difficult to fast because of hunger, and weakness. Okay, and also mothers who are feeding, they find it difficult to fast either because of the hunger or weakness issue or because of concern about their supply of milk in order to feed their babies. So if a woman is expecting, okay, and she fears that fasting will harm her or the child's health, fasting is not an obligation. Okay, now fears, meaning that if she's sure that it's going to cause her harm or a child harm, then obviously she shouldn't fast. If she thinks that it might, I mean that like it's like she's not sure, but she thinks that it might, that also would mean that she doesn't fast. Even if she just fears it, meaning like let's say it's like, I don't know, 20% chance or something, not sure, but I fear that this is going to cause harm, then fasting is not an obligation. In some cases, it's haram for her to fast then if it actually. If I want significant harm, and those that's what's mentioned in the slide there about when is it going to be haram. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say that okay, she goes for an ultrasound, and then the doctor tells her that she has to, and then she consults the doctor. Doctor tells her that you need to eat frequent meals in order to ensure proper growth of your child. Okay, so in that case, that gives her that fear based on rational grounds that fasting is going to cause harm to her child's health. So in that case, then she doesn't have to fast. Now, if she doesn't fast. Like, let's say a woman is expecting, she doesn't fast, then she will have to make up the qada at some later date. Also, she might have to give a fidya. Okay, and as we said, fidya is 750 grams of food to a poor Muslim and mu'min. The fidya is to be given when she is close to delivery. Okay, but let's say, so what does it mean to close to delivery? Let's say she's in her eighth or her ninth month. She's, I think they call it, there might be a term, like late term, if I'm not mistaken. Anyhow, she's close to delivery. In that case, she doesn't fast. She has to give the qada and the fidya. But if it's before that, it's like, let's say the first 6 months or something, she doesn't fast because of those reasons that we mentioned, then the only thing that she would have to do is to make up the qada. If at any time anybody has questions, please feel free to type them into the chat window. Now, there's another case where, okay, now the baby has been delivered, alhamdulillah. Now she is feeding the child, but she's concerned about issues relating to it causing low milk supply. She doesn't drink water, not going to have enough to be able to generate the milk. It's going to perhaps cause harm to the child. So once again, if she has fear of harm, then it's not an obligation for her to fast. Now, when you go to the rulings, you'll see something, according to some of the maraji, they'll say that it's ihtiyat wajib for her to use an alternative if available. Now, what does that mean, an alternative? Meaning that, let's say that somebody has the option of having a wet nurse, like you know, somebody else feed their child. Then they have to use that option. It's ihtiyat wajib for them to use that option. But in all these cases, there's still that thing about it not causing harm to the child. So let's say that there is an option of using, you know, somebody else to feed the child, but that child, that person isn't a Muslim. Now, we're told about, there's recommendations in about whom to use as like a wet nurse if somebody needs to do that. And there's a lot of emphasis on finding somebody who would mean that the state of the iman of the person who's feeding the child makes an impact on the child's spiritual development. So in that case, if it's somebody who's not a Muslim, then that would be I'd be harming my child's spiritual growth. I wouldn't have to choose that as an option. What about formula? Like, let's say the mother, you know, isn't able to, is concerned about, you know, low milk supply, but she has the option of using formula. Well, once again, like if based on her research, she feels that formula milk actually causes harm, and it doesn't give you the same thing as the real milk, then she wouldn't have to use the formula milk. She would just basically feed the child, not fast, and then make up the fast later on, and then give fidya as well too. Okay, the next topic I want to cover is fasting and traveling. Okay, fasting and traveling. Am I allowed to travel? First of all, am I allowed to travel during the Ramadan? The answer is yes. Okay, that I can travel, although it might be makruh in some circumstances to travel. But it is something which is allowed. Now, let's say that somebody is traveling. You know, I'm talking about like the Islamic definition of traveler. And what is the Islamic definition of traveler? I'll just mention it briefly here. If people have questions about it, make sure that you type it in. But basically, if somebody is going, you know, away from their hometown to some other place, and in that place they're going to stay there for less than 10 days, and the purpose of going is something that's halal, then when they go, when they're going and when they go there, and they're considered to be a traveler, and during that state of being a traveler, the prayers are shortened, meaning that 4 rakat prayers are turned into 2 rakat prayers, and also one is not able to fast. One is not allowed to fast, meaning that you can't fast. Okay. So now let's say somebody is a traveler. They're going to, like, you know, visit their mom, or I don't know, they're going to visit a friend for like a week, less than 10 days, and that person lives in another town. Then when they're there, they can't fast. It's still mustahab for them to stay away from food, drink, And some of the other things that are mentioned during the daytime of the month of Ramadan. Okay, now, so if I do travel, a little bit more detail. If travel, I'm exempted for fasting and my fasting is invalid unless, number one, I'm planning to stay in a place for 10 days or more. That's pretty clear, meaning that I'm going to some place, I'm going to spend 10 days in that place, meaning I'm not going to travel more than roughly 14 miles outside of the city. I'm just staying within the 14-mile radius for 10 days or more. In that case, then I'm exempt. I do have to fast if it's a month of Ramadan. Another time when I would be fasting is that I'm traveling, but I'm considered a frequent traveler, kathir safar. Another time where I would be traveling, but I still would fast would be is if I'm traveling to my watan, if I'm staying in my watan. So I'm going to explain frequent traveler and watan right now in the next slides. Another time where I would fast despite traveling would be when the travel is for a sinful purpose. Somebody's going, na'udhu billah, they're going to Las Vegas, for example, to gamble in the casinos in the month of Ramadan. May Allah protect us, right? The purpose of that travel is haram. So as, they would have to fast, basically, when they go. All right, now, let's see. The first thing about a frequent traveler. Now, I'm mentioning this because there's a lot of confusion sometimes about this. Who is a frequent? A frequent traveler is somebody who prays full and can fast despite traveling. Okay, fine. Now, what does it mean to be a frequent traveler? This is where there's a bit of difference among the maraji. First, I want to explain the viewpoint of the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei on this issue, and then the fatwa of Ayatollah Sistani on this issue. All right, Ayatollah Khamenei says that if my work is his definition of frequent traveler revolves around somebody who's traveling for work purposes. If my work is commonly considered to be in a different city than my hometown. Okay, let's say that I live in, in, let's say, Toronto. Okay, I travel to, let's say, another city completely outside of the greater Toronto area. Like I travel to, let's say, Waterloo or Kitchener. Okay, which is, let's say, about a couple hours away, or an hour and a half away. I go to work there. Okay. Now, if I ever travel to work three times without there being a 10-day gap in between the travelers, upon starting the third trip, I become a frequent traveler. So let's say I travel from Toronto to Kitchener, which is 1.5 hours away. I travel once a week for work purposes. Okay. That's fine. And if, as soon as I do that, three times, then I would become a frequent traveler. Okay, if I go twice a week, three times a week, four times a week, even once a week, then that would be enough for me to be a frequent traveler for work purposes. Okay, and then there's a ruling that, let's say I don't go for like 10 days to work, I take vacation, I'm just at home. In that case, then there's a special ruling. I'm not gonna go into it, it's on the slide. If somebody wants to refer to that later on, they can, inshallah, do so. According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's a bit different. First of all, he doesn't talk about it being somebody becoming a frequent traveler just for work purposes. Any type of travel, when it's done repeatedly, it can make somebody become a frequent traveler. Now, how frequently do you have to travel in order to become a frequent traveler? First of all, he says that look and see how many months of the year you're going to be traveling. If it's the case that in the upcoming year, you're going to be traveling for 6 months, of this year. So within 6 months of that, you're going to be traveling. Or within the next upcoming 2 years, you're going to be traveling for at least 3 months of both of those 2 years. And within that month, you are going to travel for 10 days or more. Then you would be a frequent traveler. Now, what does that mean? Like, how do we understand that? Let me give you an example. Okay, let's say that I go to work twice a week, and my workplace is in a different city. Okay, fine. So I go twice a week. So in a month, I will go Let's say I go 3 times a week. Okay. I go 3 times a week to work, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. So in a month, I'll go roughly, say, 12 times a month. Okay, I go 12 times a month. That means that I would be a frequent traveler because for at least 6 months of the year, I'm going to be traveling for, meaning that I'll be traveling for 60 days or more in those 6 months. Okay, so let's say I'm going to university. I go to university, I commute to university 3 days a week. But I only do that in the school year. In the summertime, I'm at home. So for 9 months of the year, I go to university 3 days a week, and my university town is in a different town. It's you know, more than the distance, more than 14 miles away from the edge of the city that I live in. But I only do it for 9 months of the year. Once again, that will be enough to qualify me as a frequent traveler. Now, it doesn't have to be consecutive. No, it doesn't have to be consecutive. Meaning that within 60, so for 6 months, let's say I do like, 3 days a week that I'm a traveler. It doesn't have to be consecutive. That would be enough. Okay. Out of 6 months, in the first month, I travel for 20 days. In the third month, I travel for 20 days. And in the fifth month, I travel for 20 days. Okay. And it doesn't have to be consecutive. That would, again, qualify me as being a frequent traveler. This one is a bit hard for me to explain, but if you think about it, it's actually very simple. Like, just a matter of, like, you know, calculating it out, doing the math, and then you can figure out whether you're a frequent traveler. Very, very straightforward. Now, the question that people ask is that, let's say that I am a frequent traveler. What about my other travelers, my other travels? Let's say, like, that I travel, for example, because of my university, I travel for 9 months of the year, 3 days a week. I become a frequent traveler. Now, what about when I go traveling for another reason, like for going to visit my grandmother who lives like in a totally different city, or I'm going for ziyara or Hajj and Umrah or these type of things. Now, this again is where there's difference of opinion among the Maraji. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, first of all, I can only become a frequent traveler due to work travel, not due to, like, say, university travel. Or sometimes, let's say somebody lives in a town, but the nearest Husseiniya is in a totally different city, like, and it's far away. They travel for an hour, but they go there, frequently. In that case, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, just because they're not for work reasons, they just go there for, like, joining the congregation. That's not going to be able to qualify them as a frequent traveler, only for work reasons. And then he says that, according to his opinion, his legal opinion, for other travels, then you would not be a frequent traveler. I mean, you do have to pray shorten and you can't fast for them. According to Ayatollah Sistani, however, once you become a frequent traveler, then for all your travels, you pray full and you're able to fast on all of them. Okay, now the other one we said is that if you are in your watan, even if you're there for less than 10 days, then you can fast and you pray full. All right, so then what is the watan? I just want to take a quick poll here. What do you guys think a watan is? What is a watan? Like, how does a place become a watan? Anybody want to give it a shot? You can just type it out. Okay, good. So this is good. Like, that's exactly what I was looking for. A lot of times people think that the watan is where you're born. Now, there's the word watan in Arabic does mean hometown, but when we're talking about Islamic law, one's watan has a very particular definition. We need to understand exactly what that definition is. So sometimes people say that it's where you own your home, but let's see. So these are things that people say, but let's see actually what is the ruling regarding watan. So how does a place become my watan? According to Ayatollah Khamenei, having an intention to settle down in a place for 7 to 8 years or more. Okay, it doesn't have to be the case you own a home there. It doesn't have to be the case that you live there the most of the time. It doesn't have to be the case that you were born there, but it's the place where you have the intention to settle down for a long period of time, that you're going to be taking it as your hometown. Ayatollah Sistani is very similar. He's saying you have an intention to stay in a place long enough so that I'm no longer considered a traveler there. Meaning I'm settling down in this place. Now I might be there in an apartment, I might still be traveling to other places, but it should be the case that I'm no longer considered a traveler there. Now, he gives an example, like he says that, how do you know whether you're considered a traveler there or not? Let's say that you were to go off and you were to go to, let's say you went on a trip for like 2 weeks, okay, and you left for like 2 weeks. Would people expect that you are going to come back to this town? Or would they think that, oh yeah, he's moved along? Like, you know, that's kind of like a way of telling whether it's somebody's hometown or the place that people expect you to go back to and kind of be stationed in. That's one's hometown. Now, so for example, let's say that somebody goes to university and they live in the dorms at university, but they only do so during the school year. They don't do so during the summertime. They're only going for 9 months. Or let's say that they're going there, but they're planning on going for like 4 years. It's just like they're going to finish like this, like a bachelor's degree for 4 years. In that case, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, then even if they're planning on being there the full year for like 4 years, they wouldn't become, that place wouldn't become their watan. Ayatollah Sistani, however, he gives an example of like, of a number of like 1.5 years or more. Just saying that, like, for example, as soon as you stay, you're intending to stay in a place for like 1.5 years or more, roughly speaking, then people would say that this is where they're staying. This is their hometown. That would be enough to make that place somebody's watan. Okay, now, let's say that I've taken a new watan. Like, let's say I moved to a different town. I move from Toronto to, let's say, Montreal. Okay, I moved to Montreal. Now, I intend to make that place my new watan. I'm planning on staying there for a long time. How long does it take before the rules of the watan kick in? And now, meaning that, like, even if I'm there for like 2 days or 3 days, I still pray full and I can fast. According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's 1 month. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's a few nights. Now, what does that mean for 1 month? What do I do in that month? Then, and if somebody has questions about that, you can ask, inshallah. It's important just for us to know, but then if it comes up, we can know the details. And yes, somebody can have according to these true marajas, somebody can have multiple watans. In fact, you can have many watans. Why? And that comes to our next slide, which is that how does a place stop becoming a watan? If I move from my watan and I'm confident that I won't come back to live there again, that place is no longer a watan, even if it was my birthplace. Okay, so let's say that I'm born in Karachi, Pakistan. All right, now I moved out of there, let's say when I'm 18 years old, but you know, it wasn't that I moved out thinking that that's it, I'm out of here, I'm never going to come back again. I moved out thinking that, you know, inshallah, when I make my money and, you know, things are, my kids go to school or like that, then I'll go back to Karachi, Pakistan, and I'll settle down there. In that case, I never left it with the intention of i'arad, i'arad meaning the intention of leaving it and not coming back again. In that case, even if I were to go to Karachi for like 3 days in the month of Ramadan, I would fast and I would pray full. But let's say that, you know, I was born in Toronto, and at the age of 5, my parents, you know, left and I went along with them, and they said, that's it, we're done with Toronto, never going to come back here again. In that case, then if I were to later go back to Toronto, even though I was born there, and I'm going there for less than 10 days, I would pray shortened prayers and I would not be able to fast. So that means that from an Islamic perspective, one's watan, even their watan asri, meaning like the place that they grew up in, that can stop being their watan if they do i'arad, meaning that they leave without having the possibility of, you know, with the intention of not having the possibility of going back again. It can no longer be their watan. Okay, now let's say I'm traveling, right? How, like, when, you know, what about, like, is there any way that I can keep my fast when I'm traveling? And the answer is yes. Okay, these are special exceptions. If it's the case that I leave after Dhuhr, Okay, I started out the morning in my watan, or someplace I'm staying in for 10 days or more. And then, I do my dhuhr prayers and then I head out. In that case, I have to keep my fast. The other situation is where I'm traveling, I'm outside of the city, and then I come back before dhuhr into my hometown or into some place I'm going to stay for 10 days or more. In that case, if I haven't done anything to break my fast, meaning that I didn't have breakfast in that morning, I just, you know, I didn't, I, of course I couldn't keep the intention of fasting because I was a traveler. But if I haven't done anything to break my fast, then if I arrive before Dhuhr, then I have to keep the fast for that day. Okay, now if I am traveling, right, is it just like, let's say I wake up in the morning, I know that I'm gonna be flying off to, like, I don't know, China today or someday. Okay, then is it the case that, okay, I know I'm gonna be traveling anyway, so I can have breakfast that morning. And is the month of Ramadan? Obviously not, right? I have to keep that fast until I actually leave. Now, what does it mean to leave? What it means is that I have to have crossed what is called the Had at-Tarakhus. Had at-Tarakhus means that it's that place after which the people of the city can no longer see you. So that's in a situation of where you're living, like you're leaving your hometown. So let's say that like I go to the airport at 10 in the morning. I'm flying to China. It's month of Ramadan. I go to the airport in my hometown though. Okay, I still have to fast. I have to fast. I have to not, refrain from I'm doing anything to break my fast all the way until when I'm in the plane. Even when I'm in the plane, when the plane is still on the landway, on the landing, whatever it's called, the runway, I still have to fast until the plane gets in the air and goes far away enough from the city that I would be hidden from the sight of city dwellers. Okay, at that point, then I can have my cup of coffee and break my fast. Okay, now is my salah qasr if I travel from Kitchener. Okay, how far is Kitchener from? Okay, how far is Kitchener from? How far is Milton from Kitchener? Well, let me just give you the answer. If Milton is a different city than Kitchener, definitely. If Milton is more than 14 miles away from the city limit of Kitchener, then yes, your salah would be qasr. Okay, that is if you are not a frequent traveler. Okay, if you are a frequent traveler, then the rules are according as we had talked about. If you're not a frequent, let's say that you just go, like, you're just going just for a trip, and it's more than 14 miles, then your salah would be qasr when you are praying in Malta. Okay, now what if I have qada fasts to make up? Now, sometimes I don't know how many I have to make up, right? Let's say that somebody has qada fast. First of all, we should mention that making up qada fast is obviously it's wajib, right? Something that somebody must do. Now, what if we're unsure about how many it is that we have to make up? Then, generally speaking, if we have a lower bound and an upper bound, let's say somewhere between 10 and 15, then we have to go with the lower number. That's what's wajib. Let's say between 10 and 15 fasts. I'm not sure. Over the last 10 years, I missed between 10 and 15 fasts. I have to think about it, and that's the number I came up to. I thought about it, that's the number I came to. In that case, what's wajib on me to make up is the lower number. However, there's one thing that's mentioned, and this is particular for those who do Takbir of Ayatollah Khamenei, that in the case where I know that let's say I went traveling on the 10th of Ramadan, but I'm not sure if I came back on the 15th or the 16th. Right? In that case, then I would have to make up six fasts. However, if I didn't know when I went, if I went, let's say I didn't know it was the 10th or the 11th, but I know I came back on the 15th, In that case, I would have to make up 4 because the lower number. Okay, so this is a very specific, particular ruling for followers of Ayatollah Khamenei, meaning those who look at the legal opinion and do taqiyah. Okay, now, do I have to make up a qada fast for the month before the next Ramadan? We have, you know, a few days left before the month of Ramadan. Let's say we have some qada fast to make up. According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's mustahab to do so. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat wajib to make up qada fast before the next month of Ramadan, meaning that qada from the previous year, from the last month of Ramadan. Now, let's say that I don't make it up. Okay, if I don't make it up, then what I would have, I still have to make up the qada. You know, next year I have to make it up. But the other thing that kicks in, the other thing that becomes an obligation on me is fidya. So let me give you an example. Okay, let's say last year, month of Ramadan, year 1435, month of Ramadan, I missed a fast due to illness. Okay, I feel lazy. Okay, or for some reason I'm traveling or whatever reason, I can't make up that fast before this next month of Ramadan coming up next week. Now, according to Ayatollah Sistani, I haven't committed a sin. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat wajib to make it up. So if I don't, meaning that I would either have to do ruju to another marja, but if I stay with the ihtiyat, then I've committed a sin. So I have to do istighfar for that. But I would have to do a fidya as well as the qada fast next, even after the month of Ramadan. Alright, so this chart here, if you're a chart type of person, it might help to kind of make things clear. Let's look at this kind of summarizes some of the things we talked about before too. Let's look at the top. It says, if you're a nursing mother or expecting a mother, we said that, like, if you're a nursing mother or expecting a mother and there's fear of harm, okay, then you have to do qada and fidya. That's in the case. Okay, there was a problem in the network connection. Let's see if you guys can see. Do you see the chart now? And do you hear my voice? Yes, okay, alhamdulillah. Okay, there's a question about, is the entire Greater Toronto Area, Toronto, York, Peel, Halton, and Durham considered one city? The answer is that it depends on what is the commonly, meaning that if everyone who lives in this area would need to look at what is the common understanding of the Greater Toronto Area, and when is somebody considered to be traveling outside of, like, out of town. Okay, if you talk to the those who have been here for some time, you talk to the ulama who have been for some time, they typically mention that yes, that all this, that this, that for the most part, like, all these, you know, like Toronto, York, Peel, is considered one city. However, there might be some parts, like in the you know, kind of remote areas where you would be outside of, like, the city. So, for example, like, I'm not too familiar I don't know the area that well, but in the area of Caledon in the northwest, there's some parts of it which are, you know, definitely if somebody goes there, it's not considered, like, that they're traveling out of town, but there's some parts which are really off in the boonies, and there's, like, no one who lives there. They're kind of, like, it's really, like, if somebody goes there, it's like, well, you're traveling outside of the city. It'd be hard to press to say that that is within the same city, meaning that, like, for example, if you outside, like, after Bolton, in the northwest of the city, then that would be, it seems that wouldn't be considered part of the bigger city. Okay, so we said that in the upper left corner, the nursing mother and expecting mother, if they have fear of harm to their child, then they have to make up qada and fidya, but that's if the mother is in her last month of pregnancy, if she's before that, like if she's not in her eighth or ninth month, then she wouldn't have to give the fidya. Okay, now, and then the qada has to be made up before the next month of Ramadan. If she doesn't make it up before the next month of Ramadan, then she would have to give another fidya. And what is that other fidya for? It's for her not making it up within that year. So it's possible that a lady who, you know, is, say she's pregnant in the first month of Ramadan, not able to fast. The second month of Ramadan, she's not able to fast because of the feeding issue. Then she would have to give two fidyas, one for not being able to fast in the first one, and then one for not being able to make up the fast before the next month of Ramadan. Okay. Now, if somebody, however, in the lower left of the chart, you have three cases where, if you have an ill person, a traveler, or somebody who is in a state of haid or nifas, in that case, after the condition passes, then once again, they would have to make up the qada. If they don't make up the qada before the next month of Ramadan, then they would have to give the fidya for not doing so. And they would still have to make up the qada, but in the subsequent years. Okay, so the question is, my family lives in Mississauga and go to them often, at least once a month, and is my salah qasr? The answer is, well, was Mississauga ever a hometown for you? Did you ever live there? Okay, no. All right. Now, if you go there once a month, then no, you're not. Then if you go there once a month, then your salah would be qasr when you go there. Yes. Okay. However, if you go there frequently, like let's say you go there, you know, like 10 days in a month. Okay. Then. If this is according to Sistani, if you go there like 10 days in a month, then you would become like a frequent traveler, then you would pray full when you go there. Okay, if you follow Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa on this, as we said, that you can only become a frequent traveler if you go travel because of work purposes. So in that case, if you're going to visit family, then you would always do qasr prayers when you go there, and you wouldn't be able to fast when you go there if you left before the dhuhr time from your hometown. Okay, Addison. Okay, now what is fidya? We said fidya is one mud, which is 3/4 of a kilogram of food. It's better that it be wheat, and it's to be given to a poor Muslim anywhere in the world. According to Ayatul Sunni, ihtiyat wajib, that Muslim should be a mu'min Shia. Now, this is different than just giving somebody a meal. We have to give, sometimes we give somebody a meal and it's less than that amount of food. It has to be 3/4 kilogram of food. Now, you can give fidya for multiple days to one person. You have to give the food itself, not just money, to that person. An exception is where, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, if you give money to somebody and you trust them that they're going to take that money and they'll be your wakil, your representative in turning that money into food and then having that as food, that would be fine. Now, you can appoint a wakil who will take the money and distribute on your behalf. So if you know some charities, and there are charities that are reliable, trustable, that you can tell them that you can give them money and you tell them to give the food to that person who is not the 3/4 food to that person who's needed, then that's fine as well. Now, it doesn't need to be given right away, but it shouldn't be delayed where you'd be considered as being negligent, where you're not really taking it seriously. Okay, now, what are the things that break my fast? So there's some common sort of issues that come up about breaking fast. There's these nine things that are mentioned, but we're going to go through in a little bit more detail, because some things, like there's like sort of footnotes and kind of clauses and conditions where it is that it breaks your fast. So first of all, no food and drink, all right? I can't eat or drink from Fajr to Maghrib. So as soon as I am sure that Fajr has set in, okay, until the time that I'm sure that It is Maghrib time. I cannot eat or drink. So if I have food in my mouth and I'm sure that Fajr has set in, then obviously I have to spit it out. Now, eating or drinking has to be done deliberately. So let's say that I forget I'm fasting. I just out of habit, I go to the water fountain, I drink some water, and then I'm like, oh, oops, I was fasting. I shouldn't have done that. In that case, my fasting is not made invalid. I'm still in a state of fasting. There's no issue. And according to hadith, we're told that that is one of Allah's hidden ways of giving rizq to you. That, because you didn't know, right? It was kind of something that just happened. Doesn't mean that we should try to make it happen for ourselves. Because if we try to make it happen for ourselves, then it would be deliberate and it would be breaking our fast. But if it happens just out of, like I said, out of forgetfulness, then it's fine. Eating, drinking, in order for my fast to be broken, it has to be swallowed. If I don't swallow it, like if I just put it in my mouth, but I don't swallow something, then it's not gonna break my fast. So like let's say there's somebody who's cooking food, they wanna just put it in their mouth, not to swallow it, but just to put it in their mouth just to taste the flavor of it without taking something down and swallowing it. That would be fine. No problem. It has to be from the outside, meaning that if it's something, let's say it's just saliva that I swallow my saliva. Well, that saliva is something, isn't coming from the outside. It's something which is in my mouth. I'm totally okay swallowing my saliva. What about phlegm and stuff that comes up when you cough or spit up? We're going to see in the next slide, and we'll see what the ruling is regarding that. It also has to be through the mouth, meaning that when it comes through other means, like for example, an IV, then the ruling is different, and we'll get to that as well too, inshallah. What about chewing a gum, odorless gum? If I'm just chewing a gum, and it's not giving me like food, or it's not giving me a flavor or giving me a juice that I'm swallowing. I'm just chewing it, and the only thing that's going down in my throat is my own saliva, then I'm okay. Okay, now what about coughing up phlegm or congestion or mucus? Now here, if somebody has a habit of licking their lips, that's perfectly fine, unless they lick their lips and they put some food on their lips, okay, and then they swallow that. Well, obviously, that would be haram. Or let's say somebody like puts up like some sort of lip gloss or lip balm or something, and they lick their lips and then they deliberately swallow that. That would be a problem as well. Okay, the criterion is it has to be swallowing something that's foreign. It's from the outside. Okay, now let's say that you cough up, like it happens, like somebody coughs up something. And now there's one time when you cough up something, it doesn't actually get to the mouth. Okay, it just kind of goes up into the throat, but doesn't come to the mouth. In that case, it's fine. You can swallow it back down again. But if it does come into the mouth, according to Ayatul Sistani, it's better to not swallow it, but you can swallow it. And this is important because like sometimes like it comes in handy, right? Somebody was telling me that like they had a cold, it was a month of Ramadan, and they were in a very important business meeting and they didn't have any tissue or Kleenex or handkerchief with them. And then they coughed and something came in their mouth and they were really embarrassed to they didn't know what to do. And so they swallowed it back down again. So they were really worried. So, but when they found out the ruling, they were very happy that it didn't affect their fast at all. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it is ihtiyat wajib not to swallow it. If it is swallowed deliberately, then qada and kafara would become an obligation. However, somebody could do ruju, and because when there's a ruling which is called ihtiyat wajib, then the marajah say that you can refer to another, the next most learned marja, who has a fatwa on that issue. And that's fine. Okay. all right. Now, can I rinse my mouth with water when fasting? Okay. So the answer is that yes, as long as you don't swallow the water. Okay, so like let's say that I'm, for example, as part of wudu, it's mustahab to rinse the mouth. So I do that. Is it a problem? The answer is no, as long as I don't swallow it. However, it's makruh to do that without a valid purpose. Okay, and it's recommended to spit out 3 times after rinsing. But basically, the thing is that if you swallow the water, then it's gonna break your fast. Now, let's say that sometimes I swallow it. I do that, and I swallow it by mistake. Okay, I put it in my mouth. I swallow it by mistake. In that case, in some circumstances, I might have to do qada. Okay, but I don't want to go into the details of that. But I'm just going to make it simple. That if you do it, you put water in your mouth. If you're sure that you're not going to swallow it, that's totally fine. There's no issue with it. Especially except for it being makruh, if there's not a valid purpose. But let's say somebody wants to clean their mouth or something, that's fine. Now, brushing. Yeah, so even if I'm feeling thirsty, I rinse my mouth. Okay, as long as I don't swallow it, I'm fine. It's my fast is valid. If I do, however, swallow it, even if I swallow it by mistake, then it's problematic. Now, let's say I clean my what about cleaning my teeth? I want to brush my teeth. So am I allowed to do that? The answer is yes. If you can brush your teeth, even with toothpaste, you can floss your teeth as well too, even with flavored floss. It's okay as long as nothing is deliberately swallowed. Now, using a wet toothbrush or a wet toothstick is makruh, but it's not haram. According to some of the maraji, using a dry brush is mustahab. However, we have to also consider something that, when let's say that it's the case that somebody's bad breath is the source of troubling other people, putting them into a state of distress. In some cases, that could be haram. So, we have to kind of be considerate about other people as well too. And there's this sort of conception that when I'm fasting, I can't put anything in my mouth. But that's not as we're learning here, and as we're being reminded here that that's not the case. And there are some cases where it's much better to make sure that we don't trouble the people around us, and then we do keep brushing and all that. Okay, now do I have to use floss or use a toothpick to remove any food particles before fasting? Let's say I wake up for suhoor or sahri, and after I'm done with that, there's some food still stuck in the teeth. Do I have to take them out? Well, the answer is that if I don't do that, am I sure that I'll end up swallowing something? Then of course I have to take it out. If I'm not sure, then I don't have to do so. No, what I said was that let's say somebody is feeling very thirsty. They put water in their mouth, not that they drink the water. They just put water in, they flush it in. It's makruh, but it doesn't break their fast. However, if they end up swallowing it by mistake, then it's problematic. Okay. Now, can I take medicine? The answer is that I can't take medicine orally, like pills and syrup, unless it's necessary. And if it's necessary, then it falls under what we talked about before when it comes to harm, and sickness. An inhaler is okay as long as it enters like the breathing passage, and I don't swallow it, right? Which it seems like that's what it is. So that would be okay. What about eye drops, nose drops, ear drops? That's okay. Sometimes you do that and you taste something in your mouth. That's fine as long as you don't swallow something. Like you're just tasting something in your mouth is not a problem. But it shouldn't be used as a way of eating or drinking, obviously. But I'm really hungry, so I'm gonna eat through my, I don't know, nose or something. I don't know. Maybe somebody could think of doing something like that. Okay. What about injections? Medicinal injections while fasting is okay. Anesthetic injections. Somebody you want to numb some area because of like some sort of thing. That's okay. According to some of the maharaja, it's better to avoid that. What about like an IV, like where you get like a food-based injection? Ayatollah Sani says it's better to avoid that. Ayatollah Khamenei says it's ihtiyat wajib to avoid that. Allergy shots would be okay as well. Ayatollah Khamenei just says that it's as long as the vein is not injected, which I don't think is what gets in fact injected when it comes to allergy shots or vaccination. You don't inject it into the vein itself. There are some things which are better to avoid, rinsing with water, etc. excessively smelling fragrance from herbs or flowers. Perfume is okay. Sometimes people get confused about that. They think that it's not allowed to smell perfume. The answer is that yes, it's totally fine. There's no problem. It's just makruh to, or better to avoid smelling fragrance from actual herbs and flowers. Using a wet toothbrush, tooth extraction, or any other action that will cause bleeding in the mouth, that's makruh. It's better to be avoided. Pointless argumentation and dispute as well too. Okay, now vomiting, well, vomiting is that if it's deliberately done, then it would cause, it would break my fast and I would have to do qadha. If it's not deliberate, I'm nauseous and, you know, without being able to control it, you know, it just kind of happens and it happens and my fast is still intact. Now, let's say I do feel like vomiting. Do I have to stop myself from that? According to Ayatollah Khamenei, the answer is that yes, if doing so will not cause harm or extreme difficulty. Or Ayatollah Sinai says, no, it's not necessary. I don't have to stop myself. Like, I don't have to try to stop myself from, like, for that process to happen. Okay, can I eat at night when I know that it will make me vomit? And the answer is yes, I can do that. But then there might be qada, which is wajib afterwards. Okay, what about belching? Belching is when somebody, like, you know, like, basically, you can read the description there. If it's the case that it will cause me to vomit, all right? This kind of, because we're saying one of the things that breaks one's fast is deliberate vomiting. So if I do something that will cause me to vomit, right, then, like, sometimes people do, like, it can happen, right? Like, somebody, because of their belching, it causes them to vomit, then I can't do that. Okay, but if I'm not sure, if I don't know that's going to happen, but then it happens, then I'm okay. Okay, inhaling dust or smoke breaks my fast when these conditions are true. That it's done on purpose, like I intended to inhale it. It's thick dust or smoke that reaches the throat. And examples would include smoke from cigarettes or tobacco, dusty air from sweeping a dusty ground, if it's a really dusty, like a thick dust, and steam as well too, but only if the steam condenses in my mouth and I swallow it. Then it becomes more like the food and drink thing. Or construction, yes. Okay, what about putting head underwater while fasting? So somebody was asking about swimming. Okay, so according to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's ihtiyat wajib to avoid putting your head underwater while fasting. Head meaning that you actually put your entire head and you immerse it or submerge it in the water. If somebody doesn't do that, like they're taking a bath, normal people, when they take normal baths, they don't put their entire head underneath the water. So that's fine. Okay, or even if somebody goes to a swimming pool and they don't put their entire head under the water, okay, that's fine, no problem. According to Sistani, the ruling is a bit different. He says that it's makruh. Okay, severely makruh, but it's not wajib to avoid it. So even if somebody were to put their head underwater, it wouldn't break their fast. Okay. Why is it makruh for women to sit in water when fasting? I haven't looked into the why behind it. Meaning, this is just one of the rules that they mentioned. I mean, usually these are based on you know, a hadith from the imams. Yes, it's okay. Yeah. All right. But it's makruh for me. It doesn't break their fast, though. Okay. Sit in water, meaning that you know, for example, to like sit in the bathtub, you know, to like spend some time. But like, obviously, washing oneself is not a problem. For anybody, taking a bath is okay as long as they don't dip their head underwater. Taking a shower is okay as well too, because when you take a shower, you don't submerge your head underwater. Really, the issue is about submerging one's head, entire head underneath the water. Okay, now the other thing that would break somebody's fast is any type of sexual intercourse or istimna. Now, even if it were something that led to that sort of thing, would also be would not be allowed. Meaning that if somebody were to engage in certain actions where they know it's going to lead to the that sort of discharge, then that would also be something that would break their fast. The other thing is that if somebody intentionally remains in a state of janaba haidh till fajr time, okay, that would also be an issue as well too, in terms of causing their fast to be invalid as well. That's why it's very important that if somebody becomes aware of the need to do ghusl of janaba, or for example ghusl of haidh, and it's fajr has not set in, they have to, it's wajib on them to perform that ghusl before fajr. Okay, now if somebody enters the state of janaba at night, if they deliberately stay in this state until the fajr time, like I said, it invalidates their fast. If there's not enough time left for a ghusl before fajr, tayammum should be done in place of the ghusl. And then once somebody does that, then fajr enters in, they are now in a state of fasting, now they can go ahead and do the ghusl before they do the fajr prayer. Now, if somebody doesn't do that ghusl, so for example, like let's say somebody enters in the state of janaba at nighttime, they wake up and they realize there's not enough time to like go for taking a ghusl. So there's like 3 4 minutes left, or 3 minutes left before the fajr time. They wake up and they're like, oh, I have to do ghusl. There's only like 3 minutes left, or they don't have access to the water. Then in that case, they would do tayammum just so that their fast would be valid, because they have to enter into the state of fasting having perform the state, the ritual of purification from the janaba. Okay, so if same thing for a woman who becomes purified from haidh at night, she would need to perform the ghusl before the fajr, or tayammum if there's not enough time before or unable to perform those. Now, let's say somebody does enter the state of janaba at night. Are they allowed to go to sleep before doing the ghusl? The answer is yes, but they have to intend to wake up for the fajr prayer, before the fajr, to be able to do that ghusl. And there's some rulings regarding what happens if they oversleep by mistake, and whether it's going to be qada or not. They're on the slides. We are running out of time here. I do want to end in just like 2 minutes here. So I'm not going to go into the details. Let me just see if there's anything else I wanted to mention about any of the rulings. Finally, there's an issue of kafara, where if somebody does deliberately break their fast with some of the things that we mentioned, in some cases they would have to do kafara. After the tayammum for janaba, they have to do ghusl, not wudu. Okay, kafara, there's some rulings about how to do kafara. They have to give feed 64 people, 60 poor people. When does kafara apply? I have the cases here, according to Al-Tuzani and also according to Ayatollah Khamenei. They'll be on the slides. And that is it. Okay, we have just a couple of minutes. Are there any more questions? No, if somebody like sort of like let's say they wake up and there's like 2 minutes left for the fajr prayer before it becomes qada, and they have to do ghusl of janaba, in that case they would do tayammum, they would say their prayers, and make sure that the salah wouldn't get qada, and then they would do ghusl after they're saying their prayers. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so somebody's saying, Salaamun Alaikum. Can I get access to the slides later for referral? Wa alaikum assalam. The answer is yes. The slides and the audio for this presentation will, inshallah, be uploaded to the Academy's website. So you can stay tuned for that. Okay, any other comments, questions? When using the inhalers and if you produce phlegm. So as we said, if the inhalers are going in the respiratory tract, you're breathing it, then no problem. If you produce phlegm, like your own congestion comes up, then we said that according to Abdul Sistani, it doesn't break your fast, you can swallow it. But according to Abdul Khamenei, if you do have phlegm that comes up to the mouth cavity, then you would have to spit it. It's ihtiyat wajib to not swallow it. Okay, anything else? Anybody? Okay, well, thank you for your participation. May Allah reward you for your desire to learn about Islam. And may He allow us to benefit from this month in the best means possible. Okay, so there's a couple of questions before we end because they took cut. However, when keeping mustahab fast, like it's good to kind of keep in mind the family and the effects it has on the family. Not to make other people sort of distressed because of our mustahab fast. This is one of the areas where mustahab fast can often create a lot of tension in the household because the whole schedule gets disrupted and it can create tempers and there can be a lot of issues that result. So the recommendation from teachers of ethics and spirituality is that when keeping mustahab fast, try to keep them as a whole family, meaning everyone's doing it. And if everyone's not doing it, then in many cases, it's better to avoid it because of all the tension and friction that it causes. And there's other ways of attaining spirituality that and closeness to Allah that would be better to pursue in those cases. Okay, and finally, there was a thing about any consequence for breaking a mustahab fast. The answer is no. If you're in a place with no tissue available, as we said, according to Ayatollah Sistani, you can swallow the phlegm. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, then you would have to, go somewhere where you get rid of it. Or you can do rujoo to Ayatollah Sistani's opinion and follow that one, which would allow you to swallow it. Okay. Thank you very much. Please keep us in your dua. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.